It's a busy time at USDA. Between trying to keep up with a busy schedule of daily, weekly, and monthly report releases while social distancing and staying home, the department has also been asked to construct COVID relief programs and payment plans. Today, we're getting updates on all the activities at USDA.
Live from a room with a view of a bustling yard farm via Farm Journal broadcast, this is AgriTalk. This morning, we begin with a conversation with Chief Economist from USDA, Dr. Rob Johansson. Then we've got USDA Undersecretary Bill Northey. And in the final segment, Rodney Wilson joins us from the American Red Cross. And right after the news, looks like an update from Greg Henderson from Drovers is in store. Handsome newsman Davis Michelson, now the host of AgriTalk, Chip Flory.
I can hear the handsomeness this morning.
I feel handsome. I really do.
This new location, the view of the yard farm.
Mm-hmm. Bustling yard farm. Thank you.
This is kind of exciting times for you.
It really is.
This is crazy, man.
And I got to tell you what, I did have to go through and do a little replanting. Fortunately, I was able to find cabbage and other vegetables of comparable size to the ones that did grow through whatever, you know, what gave us problems.
Yeah.
So I think we're back to where we need to be here, and I feel great about it. I can't wait to have some coleslaw later on this summer out of my garden.
Excellent. Excellent. I love all that stuff. Love it all.
Yep.
Love it
yep.
all. You're not going to see Big Apple Joe Stackler touching any of that, though. He's staying clear of the greens.
That's what I hear. That's what I hear. And, you know, hey, more power to him.
Unfortunately, I just discovered I have poison sumac in my yard garden.
Ooh. Let's stay clear.
Yeah.
Stay clear of that. We need you in that studio there, Joe. Stay clear of the poison sumac.
You got to switch that over to just the regular sumac instead of the poison kind. You'll like that a lot better.
I heard if you pull their fangs.
That's what I get for not reading the fine print.
That's right. Always read and follow label instructions.
I did it with some dicamba quick. What the heck?
Better hurry.
Okay. We've got I've put together an outline for the conversation with Dr. Johansson, the chief economist from USDA. I've got a lot of points that I want to cover, a lot of issues that I want to get to. And at the same time, I want to get an education on what it's like to put together those WASDE reports, the supply and demand reports. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to that conversation. And of course, Bill Northey, we'll get a download on the CFAP and some potential changes that are coming with some of the commodities that are eligible. All right. Let's get to the news. What do you got?
Well, Chip, for years now, more than 100 countries around the world have been working to revamp rules for dividing taxes collected from multinational companies. The European Union is considering taxing American internet companies, which could prompt the U.S. to respond with trade sanctions. Earlier this year, Paris suspended its national digital tax as part of a truce with the United States, and in return, Washington held off on sanctioning French imports. Yesterday, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin commented the talks are currently at an impasse. At issue are the locations where a company's revenue is generated rather than the location of paying customers. And I think that they would, that makes sense. If somebody is in your country, purchases something from outside of the country, where does that tax revenue go?
What's complicating the issues now, of course, is all the online shopping. That's what they're really trying to get figured out here. Yeah. Yep.
Well, Chip, distillate inventories fell in the most recent reporting week for the first time in 11 weeks, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. The agency says supplies fell nearly 1.4 million barrels, but remain solidly above the same time last year. Improved diesel demand is taken as a sign of the nation's recovery. And Chip, in a somewhat related note, wholesale nitrogen prices are falling at U.S. Gulf terminals, which some suggest may point to fewer than the expected 97 million acres planted to corn in the United States here. We talked with Phil Flynn about those distillate inventories, and now they're starting to fall on us. We're off 1.4 million barrels. Just for perspective, I think it was 2 weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago, we were up nine-some million barrels. And so to see us fall off here, it's not a huge fall off, but definitely worth noting.
Well, it's a change in the trend. And, and that's what is most worthy of note is that change in the trend. What do you think there, Mr. Inputs Monitor? Is the nitrogen price pressure a result of not having 97 million acres out there?
I'm not sure if it's that or, you know, if it's the same thing that supported diesel supplies previously, just the overall slowdown. I mean, ammonia, that's used for industrial uses as well. Absolutely. And then converted to anhydrous for fertilizers. Right. Urea, maybe. And they're talking increased production out of China on urea. So it's probably a combination.
Sounds like we should talk about that tomorrow afternoon, too.
I can't wait. I can't wait.
All right.
Yeah. Trade Rep Bob Lighthizer testified for more than 7 hours yesterday before House and Senate panels and committees. Lighthizer said he expects labor issues to complicate the start of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement when it goes into effect on July 1, but noted he is ready to take legal action if Mexico refuses to approve biotech products. Lighthizer also commented the U.S. has made very little headway in a burgeoning trade deal with the European Union. He noted the U.S. will keep trying to forge a deal, but he does not expect to have it finalized yet this year. Lighthizer was also very critical of the World Trade Organization. And Chip, just real quickly here, the Senate yesterday easily approved a bipartisan conservation bill. It includes mandatory funding for land and water conservation fund and would create a trust fund from unallocated energy revenues earmarked for clearing a backlog of maintenance issues in America's parks and other federal lands. Chip.
Yeah, I want to get somebody on the show to talk about that
totally.
That conservation bill and get that one figured out. All right. Thank you so much, Davis.
Sure thing.
All right. Greg Henderson, editorial director at Drovers. How you doing, Greg?
Good morning. I'm very well, Chip. Thank you.
Good, 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 good. What's going on down in Missouri?
We have a new packing plant opening up in Missouri. And, Chip, this is the old Valley Oaks State Company plant. If you remember from about 2 years ago, Valley Oaks applied to expand their feedlot, and they had a new state-of-the-art packing facility. The goal was to produce the cattle locally and, you know, from feedlot to through the processing sector. And all of that went by the wayside because the expansion of the feed yard was fought and the Department of Natural Resources in Missouri denied their permit to expand. And then there were also lawsuits filed. Basically, Valley Oaks threw their hands up and said, we can't deal with this. Yeah. Lawsuits are too expensive. Republic Foods, which is a group from Texas, bought the packing facility, and they actually started slaughtering cattle June 1, Chip.
Okay.
And their plans are to slaughter up to 1,000 head of cattle per day, and they're going to brand this product Missouri Beef. So, you know, if they 50 weeks of 1,000 head a day would put them just under 1% of the total supply, which doesn't sound like a big thing. But if you're a feed yard in western Missouri or eastern Kansas, it could have a big impact on the price of your cattle.
Absolutely, it could. And we've seen some examples of a couple of times in the last year of what a disruption of 1% can do to a market.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. All right. Thanks, Greg. We'll talk to you later.
Thank you.
That's Greg Henderson, editorial director at Drovers. Coming up next, we've got USDA chief economist Dr. Rob Johansson right here on AgriTalk. Everyone talks big yields, but Channel Seedsmen deliver advice that yields results. Every season, Channel Seedsmen match elite seed products with unmatched service and support to push the performance of every acre. That's why you can count on Channel for what you need to make the most of your season. You don't have to be a Channel customer to take advantage of this support. Visit channel.com/agritalk to sign up and receive expert advice that yields.
AgriTalk is brought to you by Bear Plus Rewards. Sign in and start earning at mybearplus.com.
Davis is excited.
Serendipity, baby.
What?
That's by accident, too.
Well, sometimes things just lock in. It's going to be a great day. That's what that says to me.
Is that it?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Big things.
Welcome back to AgriTalk. I'm your host, Chip Florey. That is Davis Michelson. We've got a USDA jam-packed day here on AgriTalk, and I'm excited about this conversation here. Let's get it started. Dr. Rob Johansson is the chief economist at USDA. He joins us right now. Dr. Johansson, welcome to AgriTalk.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Chip. Looking forward to getting into it and setting up the stage for your next speaker. Sounds like you've got a good lineup.
You bet. You bet we do. Okay. I don't expect you to know this, but I've been on a bit of a mission here to make sure that listeners understand the processes behind the USDA report, okay? And part of that process is understanding the source of where those reports come from. Your office is the source of maybe the most closely followed reports, the monthly World Ag Supply and Demand Estimates. So talk about assembling that report. What kind of an effort are we talking about here?
Well, that's a great question, and I'm sure most of your listeners are familiar with the WASD. We put it out every month. it's essentially a two-week process where we start each month compiling information, looking at the data. At this time of year, of course, we're looking closely at information we're getting from NASS on the crop production for domestic plantings and looking at the weather to understand, you know, how the crop's progressing for the major WASD crops. And so we start pulling that together. We do include a lot of expertise from around the department. So we pull in a lot of analysts from the Foreign Ag Service, both here based out of the United States, but also we get reports from all of our stations across other countries, major producing countries, to understand how they're, what's going on in the ground in, for example, South America, different countries down there, or Asia or Africa, what have you. So we get all that information starting to stream in, and we sort of compile it. We compare it to satellite information we get from NASA in terms of comparing, you know, how well the crop's progressing in different regions of the world, depending on the time of year, which crops are sort of coming into production. So anyways, that starts a two-week process, culminates in what we call lockup, where we bring folks in and, keep them sequestered, and they pull together the numbers, and we put it out as part of our reporting. It comes out at the same time as NASA's crop production, so... Yeah. At the same time crop production comes out for the U.S., we put out the World Ag Supply and Demand Estimates, which includes all that NASS information, but also includes a lot of other information from around the department.
Two-week process. You mean it's not just a half a dozen guys sitting around in a room throwing the numbers together?
That's right. It's not just that, although I think folks may understand it that way. There are certainly the chairman of each commodity, the chairman of the ICECs, as we call them, pull together their teams, and they've got participants from, as I mentioned, NASS and FAS, but also from, of course, Economic Research Service, from the Farm Service Agency, from the Ag Marketing Service. We get data from all of these agencies, whether that be sales data or inspection data or certified acre data. All of that plays a role in how we pull together our estimates. Of course, we're moving into a very interesting time, as the crop starts to progress and we start getting more yield estimates coming out of NASS for the U.S. crops.
Right. Now, prior to those survey-based estimates from NASS that go at the top of the commodity balance sheets, prior to that, it's a yield projection, right? Talk about that.
Yeah, that's right. So generally speaking, we've got our acreage planning intentions from the NASS survey administered sort of at the end of February, at the beginning of March. So in this case, it's kind of an interesting year because a lot of that survey work went on before all of the coronavirus impacts hit the market. So, of course, then again, we'll get the June actual planting survey from NAS. This year we should have pretty good information because the year has been progressing pretty quickly. Your listeners will remember last year there was a lot of controversy over this because of how late planting was last year. We had a lot of prevent plant, a lot of uncertainty around the actual acreage numbers last year. I'll just say that if folks go back and look, we came pretty close even back early in the year to what the actual production was. But I know that at the time we were taking a lot of incoming criticism from from the ag sector on those estimates. And if you look, when we put out those estimates for end of year production, we put them out as early as, you know, June, July, and August. Those numbers are pretty much primarily based on our yield estimates and the acreage numbers that we're getting from those surveys. We do adjust the yield number to your specific question based on if we've seen, for example, significant drought occurring in those earlier months, or if we've seen, for example, significant heat occurring. Usually that isn't the case, but of course, if we go back to 2012, you can recall when we had a pretty significant impact on corn and soybean yields, for example. And so we have incorporated the ability to adjust for significant weather impacts earlier in the season before we do get the objective yield data coming out of NAS.
Okay, excellent. Now let's go from the top of the report down to the bottom of the report. And this is one, or balance sheet. And this is one of the reasons that I want to get you on, because I had a question from Twitter. It came in from @ XZD Goat. He said, I see the projection, the projected on-farm price for corn is 320. What basis are they using, or how do we correlate that to futures?
Well, you know, of course, we can look at futures, and we'll see, generally speaking, futures prices and cash prices will converge towards the end of the year. As if we're looking at, for example, December futures prices for corn. You know, what we're looking at right now is we do, NAS is, of course, asking producers what they're getting for their crop as they develop their ag prices. And so we incorporate that data. Now, of course, that's going to change over the year as things happen. Mm-hmm. So right now what we're doing is we're looking at projected global stocks and, you know, demand for corn over the next year, trying to figure out where those supply and demand curves cross, and that'll give us our price. Now, if things happen throughout the year, for example, we have a drought, or we have exceptionally good planting weather, or, for example, we see Brazil pulling out a record crop from their second crop corn, that'll obviously push those stocks around a little bit, and that'll change the point at which demand crosses that curve, and that'll give us a different equilibrium price, if you will, for corn. Now, so we have our estimation methods for doing that earlier in the year. Those are important. As we get more information about, for example, in the previous crop year, we're seeing those sales occur. So we can adjust based on actual observations. Obviously right now nobody's marketing the new crop corn, so we're not seeing any observations of that. But as we get later in the year, we'll be able to reconcile that a little bit. Okay. So in the November, December period, we'll actually see quite a bit of marketings. Yep. We'll see what the prices were, and we can adjust up or down. Now, we're doing that, of course, for wheat right now, for winter wheat, but also for we'll adjust, obviously, all the back year commodities because those are still being marketed right now.
Very good. Very good. Yeah, it's a weighted average, so we need to take that into account. Let's talk about some revenue projections here real quick, just in the last minute or so. What would farm revenue look like without the government payments, first of all? And number two, have the government payments for 2020 been underestimated, do you think?
Well, there's a lot in that question. So, I'll just think about, if you think about net farm income in the United States, that's not the exact same thing as revenue, but it's usually it's one good metric that we sort of start with. Net farm income in the U.S. is, you know, in the, say, $90 billion range. Government payments are normally between 5 and 10% of that. So think about ARC PLC, CRP, conservation programs, and the like, those add up to, more or less, depending on how you classify them, whether they're in the WTO, but those usually add up to about $18 billion. Now, of course, that's more than 10% of that number I just gave you, but a lot of those don't count towards actual production. So at least you're giving me the music. Right now, of course, we've got the CFAP program that we're just rolling out. Now, you can ask Undersecretary Northey about that. That's a $16 billion program by itself.
You bet.
Of course, we didn't count on that, but even with that CFAP program, with all the coronavirus impacts we've seen, we're likely to see a decline in net farm income this year.
Dr. Rob, thank you so much. Appreciate your time.
All right. Thanks so much.
Time for Markets Now with the experts from Pro Farmer.
And joining us now is Pro Farmer editor Brian Grady. Beej, we've got a little bit of strength going in corn and soybeans. What's happening?
Well, on the soybean side of things, Chip, really strong export sales this morning. China was the big buyer, especially on new crop there, taking over 1 million tons. So that's got us up a little bit here. The meal market's participating, which is helping out. But just mostly corrective trade, I would say, at this point in time, based on some of those export numbers for the soybeans.
All right. Yeah, that export number in there, the new crop number was outstanding, and China was right there taking most of it, right?
Correct. Yep, that's right.
Yep. Okay. We just having a hard time finding a footing this week.
Well, seasonally, we've talked about it, but U.S. harvest is underway here, and SRW contracts are struggling. Did trade higher earlier, but once we got to daytime trade, we've seen the buyer interest dry up and the sellers start to get a little bit more courage, and that's kind of what we're seeing. Also, some spreading. Spring wheat futures are higher, and the winter wheat markets are under some pressure.
Okay, take us over to livestock.
Yeah, the disappointing trade in the hog market, export sales this morning, I would consider them pretty good with Mexico and China both in as big buyers for the week. But yet the futures are struggling to find buyer interest and under a little bit of price pressure. So it's not heavy by any means, but still disappointing that it's under pressure with a good, strong weekly sales. Cattle market, it's being led lower by feeder cattle, moderate to sharp losses there, and slight to moderate losses in the live cattle market.
All right. Thank you, Brian. Appreciate it. We'll talk to you again tomorrow. That is Pro Farmer editor Brian Grady on Markets Now.
Opinions expressed on AgriTalk do not necessarily reflect the views of Farm Journal Broadcasting, affiliate stations, or sponsors.
I'm Andrew McRae, inviting you to join me for Farming the Countryside, a farmer-focused podcast important to agriculture. It's brought to you by Pivot BioProven. Visit pivotbio.com to find a representative near you.
Welcome back to AgriTalk, everyone. I'm your host, Chip Flory. Friend of the show, USDA Undersecretary for Farm Production and Conservation, Bill Northey, joins us right now. Undersecretary Northey, it's good to talk with you again. How are you?
I am great. Finding things to do out here. But great to be on with you again, Chip.
Good. Good deal. You know, Iowa in August isn't going to be the same without the state fair, Bill.
Oh, man. It sounds like they're actually still going to try and pull off the governor's charity steer show, but it will be a big hole, and I think that's true in a lot of states. But certainly, we're both aware of what a big deal the Iowa State Fair is to Iowa.
Yeah, that's right. You know, it's a good. I hadn't heard that they were still trying to pull off the governor's charity steer show, and I got to thinking about that the other day. My gosh, what a hole that would leave for the Ronald McDonald House, Bill.
Yeah, I think it was over $200,000 they raised last year. And you think all across the state fair, there's so many pieces from charity fundraisers like that to organizations that it's a big part of their budget, the money that they raise, to businesses, as well as the rest of us that plan that for our vacation time. There's a lot of impact when a fair doesn't happen.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Okay. Execution of the Coronavirus Food Aid Program, CFAP. How's it going? What's the status? What's the feeling of the program now?
You know, we're seeing a lot of sign up. We announce each week where we're at, and earlier this week we announced that we have just under $3 billion worth of payments that have been made out of the $16 billion in payments, so a little less than 20% of the payments. So we're seeing folks use the website, the farmers.gov website, and the spreadsheet that's on there, and either mail information in or drop it by the office or use other ways of getting that information in. We do have lots of different commodities. We have folks with lots of different marketing arrangements that are working through those pieces. And then, you know, the other bucket we've talked about is for those commodities not covered in CFAP right out of the box, we had an opportunity for them to come forward in what's called Notice of Funds Availability, a NOFA process. And we're nearing the end of that. I think it's next week when folks will have provided us information about why they should be involved, and we'll start going through, or we've been going through, the things they brought in and decide which ones may therefore be able to be covered still in this sign up, as well as there's lots of conversations about whether there ought to be future programs and what that would look like as well.
Yeah, exactly. I want to get to that in a moment. For some of these producers, this is their first time that they've had to use the Farm Service Agency office, right?
It is. I think especially if some of the livestock producers in heavy livestock areas without a lot of crop land, and so we have some cow-calf producers in the West that they may have used conservation programs, therefore be in our system,
right,
but they may not have. As well as some of the specialty crop producers that if they weren't producing a commodity, what we call a Title I commodity like wheat or something else, and had a reason to participate, they were not, they didn't know where the county office was as well, and we've got to put them into our system. And so that can take a little extra time for folks.
Okay. $3 billion in checks out of the $16 billion in the program. What's the status on getting as much of the funding out into farm country as we can?
We're going to see it keep going here. We are just paying 80% of what a producer application says they've earned. And for right now, we're going to continue that rate until we can see a little farther on that that's going to be sufficient or not. Obviously, we haven't figured out those other commodities that will be engaged, and we haven't seen that start to tail off by any means yet. But as soon as we can figure that out, we'd like to be able to cut a check for that last 20% for producers. We think that our sign up ends at the end of August. We think that we'll see an awful lot of producers have the process completed within the next month or so. And we'll know where we're at and hopefully be able to make a decision to get the rest of the dollars out as soon as we can.
Yeah. It seems like the comfort level with what is really available through CFAP is high enough now that we are starting to see some of those that were just kind of like, yeah, you know what, I'm going to wait, I'm going to hold off. Now they're going in and getting signed up.
It does seem like that. And I think they've, you know, and it took some discussion of what's a grain, what's an unpriced grain contract, is a basis contract or a hedge to arrive, and how do we look at those? And we have some of those tools on the website as well, the farmers.gov website, that will help people walk through if they have some questions on some of those programs. We still work through it on some of the specialty crops too. We have, you know, scores of specialty crops that are covered, and exactly what's covered and what fits into, with kind of three buckets there, what fits into bucket one, two, or three, and why. And there's some explanations on the website. And I think folks are getting more comfortable.
Right. Absolutely. What have we learned from this round that you think will be taken forward to what is, you know, it's widely expected that there's going to be another round of aid? Or I should ask you this: do you suspect that the next round is going to come with some more guidance from the Ag Committee on how it should be implemented.
Yeah, I do think that they'll look, you know, there were real questions. We had to, if we were going to get a program out, we had to have kind of a end of period. So we had our April, mid-April date that had caused some heartburn within some of the livestock community, some of the specialty crop community as well. But otherwise, to wait until the impact's all done meant checks wouldn't be coming out for months from now.
Right.
So it made sense to go forward, but that created a cliff for those that were on the later side of that April 15th date. So I think that's one of those things that folks are thinking about. How do we help with that? What's a program look like that doesn't create another cliff with another date going forward as well? I think we're looking at that. Certainly the Hill's trying to figure that out, trying to figure out if there's some commodities that are left out that they're hearing from their constituents. You know, some of the commodities, it's some of the storable specialty crops are really tough. Potatoes, onions, even apples, and some of those are tough. Some of the commodities that are there's kind of two markets in. I've spent some time talking to the egg producers in Iowa. You got liquid and shell eggs, and some of those fit into this formula very well, and some of those we're getting some real help to try and figure out how they can fit.
Okay, so a farmer comes to farmers.gov and they're looking for information on CFAP. What else should they be looking for at farmers.gov?
Well, there's a lot of pieces on farmers.gov. Folks with loans can look and see what their loan payments are and see what their history is and other kinds of things. There's disaster tools, but we also just added within the last couple of weeks a new tool around conservation programs as well. We have a program called Conservation Client Gateway, and that really allows folks to be able to look at their conservation contracts, specifics around those contracts, dates, other kinds of things. They're able to sign things. Some of that's available now by via smartphone and tablet, and those tools will increase in usability too. So we're trying to create more functionality, more ways for folks to deal with offices from a distance.
Yeah.
And much of this obviously was started well before coronavirus.
Right.
But certainly plays into the need to be able to have signatures provided without somebody having to drive 40 miles to a county office.
Yeah.
That was true before we had social distancing. Certainly true right now.
Right. Right. The thing that gets me about farmers.gov, Bill, is number one, it'll save you a phone call. Number two, you're saving time for those for the FSA office workers, because if growers would spend a little bit of time at farmers.gov to understand what's all available to them there, it'd be a much more efficient process, right?
It is, and we keep adding features, so they may have checked 6 months ago, and we've added some features that fit them a little bit better. Certainly, the CFAP, a lot of folks are using farmers.gov for the CFAP sign-up. Using that form, they can print out a form and actually sign it and send it in by email or drop it by an office, and that's their application. And so we're going to continue it, adding functionalities there that help our producers, but as you say, also help our county offices manage the workload that they all have to.
Right, right. Give me 30 seconds. What's at the top of your conservation priority list right now?
Well, we need to make sure that we're out there helping producers, and our folks have been. We've got to get some construction projects and other things done. This spring was a tough time for many of our producers. Certainly, soil health and the opportunities for no-till and building some of those conservation opportunities for producers and helping them with technical assistance as well, financial assistance, continues to be a priority for us.
Absolutely. USDA Undersecretary for Farm Production and Conservation, Bill Northey. Thank you so much, Bill. We'll talk with you again soon.
Appreciate it, Chip. Thank you.
You bet. We'll be back with more AgriTalk in a moment.
AgriTalk is brought to you by Bear Plus Rewards. Sign in and start earning at mybearplus.com.
You know, my mother's mom's mom was a Hanson.
Really?
I come from Hanson stock. Yeah.
I've got some Hanson in my family tree too, Davis.
That must be why we're such good friends and coworkers, Chip. It's in the genes.
Oh, no. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, one time I was sitting eating dinner and somebody said, can you imagine if those two families ever got together and
oh, geez.
What it would what the outcome would look like. And I was the outcome of those two families getting together. Yeah.
Well, order me up more
Shout
of the same.
Shout out to the Noachex and the Barbers there.
Noachex and Barbers. Hello. Yep.
Yeah. All right. Hey, let's have a conversation now with Rodney Wilson. Rodney is with the American Red Cross, joins us right now. Rodney, welcome back to AgriTalk. How are you?
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. I didn't know I'd be talking with the Hanson brothers.
Slapshot. There it is. Love it. Good one. Good one. Okay. We got to get serious because we're talking about a kind of a serious situation here. The blood supply in the nation because of, for several reasons, but the COVID stay home orders are certainly part of it. But the blood supply is getting very tight, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, what we've seen during the pandemic, as many businesses closed, schools closed, we saw many blood drives cancel, hundreds of blood drives cancel across the country. And very quickly, the blood supply dropped, and we had quite a severe shortage. Luckily, at the beginning of the pandemic, hospitals also canceled elective and non-urgent care. And that helped bring the need for blood down. And we were able to meet that reduced need, thank goodness. But what we're seeing now is hospitals are resuming those non-urgent surgeries, things that, you know, they're not emergencies, but they can wait a little while. But it's time to resume those treatments. And as hospitals do that, we've seen the need for blood go up by about 30% in recent weeks. And we're struggling to meet that need.
Yeah. Yeah. So in an effort to encourage donors, you made some changes on Monday of this week, right?
Well, this week we've implemented a antibody test, a COVID-19 antibody test on all Red Cross blood, platelet, and plasma donations.
Okay.
So this is not a test for the virus itself. And we want to stress that if anybody thinks that they might be ill with the coronavirus or they're not feeling well, you know, this isn't the test for you. You should not go to a blood drive. You should go to your doctor. But what the antibody test does is it searches for antibodies in your blood. And an antibody is basically your reaction to a virus. So we can search for whether or not your body has produced a reaction to COVID-19. And that will tell you if you have perhaps come into contact with the virus in the recent months.
Right. Now, if you are found to have those antibodies, what does that mean to that blood donation? Is it still usable in the normal way?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
So COVID-19 and other viruses, respiratory viruses, are not transmissible by blood transfusion. So there's no worry about contracting it or spreading it through blood. And the antibodies are not harmful in any way. So really, knowing this information is good for us to determine the prevalence of COVID-19 in our communities. There's still so much we don't know about it. We don't know how many people could potentially have come into contact with it or been carriers and never developed symptoms. We have no idea of those numbers. So by providing this test to blood donors, we'll be able to get a better look at how prevalent is it in our communities, where is it prevalent, and gather more data to understand and respond to the pandemic.
Right. Right. Okay. So let's say that I've made the decision I'm going to donate a pint of blood. How do I find the place to go do that?
Yeah, well, a great way to find a blood drive near you is on our website, redcrossblood.org. And you can go on and type in your zip code, select a date range that works for you. You can even put in a mile radius around that zip code, and it should show you all the options available to you. Now, we do still have many blood drives that have canceled and are continuing to be canceled because of the pandemic. So we don't have quite as many blood drives as we do under normal circumstances. So right. if particularly if you don't live near a large populated city, it might be a while before there's a blood drive near you. If there's not one in the next week, there might be one in the next month. So maybe increase the date range that you're looking at if you're not finding a blood drive near you.
Very good. Very good. Now, let's say that I can't find one. I just don't want to do that. There's other ways to help the Red Cross, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, the Red Cross is an emergency response organization. So, you know, we have many lines of service, and not everybody can donate blood, and not everybody is comfortable with donating blood. Mm-hmm. You know, we need more people to give blood, but you can absolutely volunteer in other capacities. If you wanted to volunteer in blood services, you can be a driver. That's really one of our biggest challenges, is getting the blood to the hospitals.
Right.
And so we have a number of people who volunteer to be drivers to pick up blood at our facilities and actually deliver them to hospitals. It's a pretty cool volunteer opportunity.
Absolutely. It's very cool. Another way that we can help the Red Cross is with a credit card number sometimes, right, Rodney?
Yeah, financial donations help make our mission possible, help us respond to emergency situations, house fires, hurricanes, tornadoes.
We
do all of that type of disaster relief as well.
It's always good to talk with you, Rodney. We'll do it again. Thank you so much for everything you do.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right. That is Rodney Wilson from the American Red Cross. All right. Hey, thanks for listening this morning. Appreciate it. You got to come back this afternoon. I'm really looking forward to the conversation. The head of the Purdue University Ag Economy Department, Jason Lusk, is going to be my guest. And then tomorrow morning, you know what it is. It's Friday. It's a free-for-all. We smart. Johnson and Haney.